The following is a production of the Media Ministry at New Salem Baptist Church in Soddy Daisy, Tennessee, featuring the teaching of Pastor Alan Rogers. If you're in the Chattanooga area, we invite you to be our guest at any of our weekly worship services, or visit us online at newsalembaptist.net. And now, here's Pastor Alan.
Is Christ King? Well, to those of us who are convinced that Jesus is the Son of God and Savior of the world, I mean, that seems like kind of a no-brainer, doesn't it? You know, as disciples of Jesus, of course, we think he's king. The only thing controversial for us about that statement is that it tends to divide those who believe in Jesus from those who do not. But did you know there's actually been a raging controversy about that phrase, both in our pop culture and in our political culture the last few years? About 6 years ago, Kanye West released a blockbuster of an album called Jesus is King. I mean, it broke all kinds of records. It won all kinds of awards. Next thing you know, he's got these huge crowds showing up for what he called his Sunday service productions. And a lot of evangelicals were rushing to embrace this brand new Kanye. I mean, think about it. One of hip-hop's biggest bad boys has seen the light. He's turned to Jesus. Now he's using his talents to serve God. And you know how we evangelicals love a good transformation testimony, right? Especially if it involves a celebrity. Anybody checked on Ye lately? I don't follow him, but from what I've seen in the news, I'm afraid he's kind of slipped back into some of his old ways. So pray for him. Pray for him. 2 years ago, the words Christ is King became the focus of a huge controversy in online political commentary. It started with an internal spat at the Daily Wire, which is the conservative media company founded by Ben Shapiro. And one of the commentators who works for the Daily Wire, who happens to come from a Jewish background, posted something on Twitter criticizing another commentator for the Daily Wire about some comments that she allegedly made about the nation of Israel. And so she posted a rebuttal, pretty angry rebuttal, and she closed it with the words, Christ is King. Now remember, she's sending this against somebody who grew up Jewish. In just a short time, that phrase began popping up all over social media. It became something of a shibboleth, both for people who were anti-Semitic and for what we call Christian nationalists, as a way for them to identify themselves online. Now, little note here, okay? This don't cost you anything extra. Christian nationalism is not the same thing as Christian patriotism, okay? It is all right to love Jesus and love your country. Let me just let you know that, okay? In fact, I put a plug in for a buddy of mine. Dan Darling wrote a book a couple years ago, In Defense of Christian Patriotism. I highly recommend it. And one of the things Dan argues for in that book is that one of the ways we can show our love for God and our love for our neighbor is by loving our country and coming together to try to make it a better place to live. So you can be a patriot and still be a Christian. Christian nationalism is a particular movement. It's a defined movement that wants to see Christianity, or at least the proponent's brand of Christianity, established as the legally enshrined official religion of the United States, and all other religious groups, even some Christian groups, would be suppressed. Now, as tempting as that idea may sound, let me just remind you, Baptists have always been nervous with that kind of project. Okay, because our Baptist forefathers remembered what it was like that to be a persecuted minority in the American colonies. The reason we have the anti-establishment clause in the Bill of Rights is because Baptists pushed for it. A little bit of history there, okay? So for Baptists, the big idea has always been a free church in a free state. Trying to keep church and state at least, you know, not hermetically sealed against each other, but at least keep the state from interfering with the church. Okay. So today, the phrase Christ is King has become a way for people holding certain ideologies to signal to one another that, hey, I'm part of the tribe, I'm down with the cause. But it also serves to confuse the rest of us. Because what Bible-believing Christian could be against the phrase Christ is King? Yeah, he's King. And I dare say that until about 2 minutes ago, most of you were blissfully unaware that this controversy even existed. Here's the funny thing. Controversies like this are not new. People have been trying to claim Jesus for their own causes and stuff him into their own agendas and squeeze him into their own molds for nearly 2,000 years. Today we're going to begin looking at one such attempt to squeeze Jesus into a particular mold. It's described in John chapter 6. It's actually the whole sixth chapter of John is about this. But we're going to focus particularly today on verses 1 through 15. And so I'm just going to read this entire passage, and then we're going to go back and walk through it. And I want you to notice four particular key ideas today. But starting in John chapter 6, verse 1. After these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, or Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd followed him, because they saw the signs which he was performing on those who were sick. Then Jesus went up from there on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was near. Therefore Jesus, lifting up his eyes and seeing that a large crowd was coming to him, said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these may eat?" This he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, for everyone to receive a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are these for so many people?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down in number about 5,000. Jesus took the loaves, and having given thanks, he distributed to those who were seated, they also of the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they were filled, he said to his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments so that nothing will be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. Therefore, when the people saw the sign which he had performed, they said, "This is truly the prophet who has come into the world." So Jesus, perceiving that they were intending to come and take him by force to make him king, withdrew again to the mountain by himself alone. Okay, 4 key ideas I want you to notice this morning out of this passage. The first one is this: Jesus did not come to found a fan club. Chapter 5, we saw Jesus continually defending his claims to be the Son of God. He did this by pointing to the testimony of witnesses, to the testimony of Scripture, to the signs themselves that he was performing. And much of this defense was made to the religious authorities that were based around Jerusalem. If I could get that map up on the screen. Chapter 5, he's down here around Jerusalem. Chapter 6 opens up, and he's all the way up here near the Sea of Galilee. Okay, we're not told exactly where, but from the clues, it's somewhere around here, around the village of Bethsaida, on the northeast side of Galilee. And we're told this event, we're not told exactly when it happened. And remember, John is more concerned about theology than he is chronology. He is, until he gets to the last week of Jesus' life, he mixes and matches to suit his argument. He doesn't necessarily put events in chronological order. But we know it's sometime in the springtime. How do we know that? Well, one, because it's near the Passover, and the Passover takes place in the spring. The other way we know it is because there's grass on the ground. In that part of the country, the spring months are rather mild and wet, and so that's when the grass grows. You get into the summertime, and the grass all turns brown. So if there's grass around, it must be early in the springtime. And we're told that wherever Jesus was going in Galilee, these huge crowds were turning out to follow him. And we're talking rock star-sized crowds here, okay? In verse 10, we find out there were at least 5,000 men in attendance. And the specific word used there is for males, for men. But we also know there was women and children on top of that, because later on they bring a little boy up. So there could have been 8,000 to 10,000 people in this particular crowd. If you've ever been to the Roundhouse down at UTC, think about how big that arena is. And think of that arena filled with people. It seats about 10,000 people. Okay, so that's a bunch of people. And all these people are gathering to hear Jesus. Now, why are all these people coming out to hear Jesus? Well, we're told in verse 2, because of the signs he had performed. And so far in this gospel, John has told us about 3 major signs. You remember he told us about the water being turned into wine at the wedding in Cana, chapter 2. He told us about Jesus healing the royal official's son in chapter 4. And in chapter 5, he heals this guy who's been lame for nearly 40 years, sitting around the pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. But in addition to that, John's also hinted those weren't the only signs Jesus did, that he apparently he was healing a lot of people. And so these people in this crowd were coming out to hopefully see Jesus do more of these amazing feats. They didn't have a lot of entertainment back then. There was no Netflix, okay? So something big like this comes to town, yeah, everybody's going to turn out to see what's happening. Maybe we'll see some more of these miracles here. They were there just for the show. They were there for the excitement. They were there for the energy. They were there hoping to see something extraordinary. They had no real investment in Jesus or what he was really all about, at least not at this point. In other words, these people were fans. They were not followers. A few years ago, Kyle Eidelman released a book called Not a Fan. And that's pretty much his thesis for this entire book. Another book I highly recommend. Eidelman's thesis was that there are a lot of people today who are content to be casual fans of Jesus instead of committed followers. And in fact, let me give you just a sample of something he says here. Most of us don't mind Jesus making some minor change in our lives, but Jesus wants to turn our lives upside down. Fans don't mind him doing a little touch-up work, but Jesus wants complete renovation. Fans come to Jesus thinking tune-up, but Jesus is thinking overhaul. Fans think a little makeup is fine, but Jesus is thinking makeover. Fans think a little decorating is required, but Jesus wants a complete remodel. Fans want Jesus to inspire them, but Jesus wants to interfere with their lives. What's going to happen to all these people who are coming out to see the show when Jesus starts meddling? When Jesus starts trying to tell them, hey, you need to make some changes in their lives. We don't have to wonder, because you jump ahead to verse 66. We read, as a result, when Jesus starts cranking up the temperature and the expectations a little bit, we read in verse 66, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So when the rubber hit the road and it started to get real, a lot of these casual fans started heading for the exits. So much for the fans. When the pressure's on, fans are fickle, but followers are faithful. So, this morning, which one are you? Are you a fan or are you a follower? Just remember, Jesus didn't come to start a fan club. Neither did Jesus come to establish an economic utopia. What comes next is the only miraculous sign that is reported on, apart from the resurrection, in all four of the Gospels. And that shouldn't surprise us, because you know, John focuses more on Jesus' ministry in Judea. The other three gospel writers focus more on his ministry in Galilee. So there's just a little overlap there. But this one is included in all four, okay? Now, the fact that this miracle appears in all four Gospels, it's the only miracle to appear in all four, doesn't that tell us something? The gospel writers thought this was pretty important. The thing is, the other gospel writers treat this miracle as an event in itself, and they go through a lot of detail explaining exactly what happened, the details of what happened. John just kind of rushes through this miracle. He rushes through the next miracle we'll look at in a couple of weeks. But then the rest of the chapter, he is relating this long explanation by Jesus into the deep significance behind this miracle. It's almost like John is saying, hey, I know Matthew, Mark, and Luke have already told you about what happened. Now let me tell you what it means. Okay? Let's set the stage. The Sea of Galilee is located in kind of a geographic bowl. If we could get that picture. Yeah, that's a shot of the Sea of Galilee. You see all these mountains and hills around it. It's in a bit of a bowl. So Jesus and his disciples find a good spot on one of these slopes to sit down and enjoy the view while Jesus did some teaching. How many of you were in school, did you enjoy having class outside? Loved it when the teacher said, hey, it's a beautiful day, let's go outside to study today. They're having class outside, looking down. And let me tell you, I've been to the Sea of Galilee. It's one of the most peaceful places I have ever visited. It's hard to believe all the violence that has taken place there over through the centuries with different armies and stuff marching through there. But when you're sitting there looking out over that water, it is one of the most peaceful places in the world. And Jesus is out there with his disciples, and they are having this class time together, and this massive group of fans gathers around them to listen in as Jesus teaches his disciples. And at some point, Jesus decides to give a pop quiz. He's going to test his disciples. We know this is a test because he asked one of his disciples an impossible question. And then John tells us in verse 6, Jesus actually already had a plan, okay? So Jesus looks at his disciple Philip and says, Philip, verse 5, where are we going to buy bread so that all these people may eat? Now, Philip was a natural person to ask this question to, because Philip was from, guess where? Bethsaida. He's from that little village there, so he knows where all the local restaurants and grocery stores are at, okay? But Philip failed the test. He gave the wrong answer. See, Philip, as soon as Jesus asked him this question, he immediately starts thinking through the logistics of feeding so many people. And he is doing some quick mental math, and he says, you know, hey, if we had 200 denarii, which is about the equivalent of 9 months' wages for the average daily worker in that time period, if we had 9 months' wages, Jesus, we couldn't even give these people a sample. Think about that. If I, you know, give a year's salary, we couldn't feed all these people. Philip fails the test because when he's asked this question, he focuses on the question of how much is it going to cost, okay? Now, as soon as Philip gives his answer, one of his buddies, Andrew, shows up with a little boy in tow. And now, to his credit, nearly every time we see Andrew in the Gospels, he's bringing somebody to meet Jesus. There's a good example there for us to follow. But like Philip, Andrew and his brother Peter are also from Bethsaida. So he too is familiar with the resources of the local community. And apparently, Andrew, before Jesus even asked this question, he's been thinking about this problem. He's already been scouting out the crowd. Because when Jesus asked this question, he's right there with this young man. However, the best he could come up with was this little boy's lunchbox. And let me tell you what that little boy's lunchbox was the equivalent of. Okay? He's got 5 barley loaves. I think barley, first of all, barley is the cheap stuff. That was the cheapest bread you could get in that time. And when they mean loaves, they don't mean like big loaves. They mean like dinner rolls. So this little boy's lunchbox had 5 dinner rolls in it and a couple of sardines. A lot of scholars think that there was just a few little fish in there and basically to use to smear over the barley loaves to give them a little flavor. Just a little bit of protein. That was it. Even Andrew is skeptical that this would be enough to feed the crowd. How are we going to feed all these people with this? See, like his friend Philip, Andrew failed the test because he's focused on the question, what's it going to cost us? The real answer to Jesus' question, okay, they didn't even think about. The real answer to the question, how are we going to feed all these people, is we can't. But God can. That's the answer Jesus was looking for. The disciples were focused on what it would cost and how much they themselves could afford. Jesus was focused on what only God could provide. To borrow from Ray Stedman, talking about this passage, Philip was thinking of money, Jesus was thinking of ministry. An atheist could have given the same answer that Philip gave. Didn't take a lot of faith to say, this is an impossible question, does it? However, a person who looks at a problem with eyes of faith can see the possibility of God's provision. Now, aren't we in church often guilty of making that same mistake? Think about that. Now, we cannot ignore the question of how much is this going to cost or how much can we afford, okay? We can't ignore those questions. But the central question we often don't get to is this: what is God leading us to do? Because once we know the answer to that question, we can move forward in faith, knowing that if God is calling us to it, He is going to provide the resources for us to accomplish it. We have to proceed with eyes of faith, trusting in the Lord. But what's this got to do with the point here? Jesus had this crowd sit down and he proceeds to feed them from the contents of this little boy's Happy Meal. Now, skeptics have tried to explain this miracle away for centuries. Oh, the little boy's selflessness in giving up his meal inspired all the other people in the crowd to bring out their meals and to share with one another. Don't laugh. People have actually tried to argue that. Oh, Jesus just gave them a symbolic sample, kind of like the little wafers we share at the Lord's Supper. People have actually argued that. But John goes out of his way to preclude any of those options, okay? His wording focuses squarely on Jesus as the one who is distributing the food. John also stresses this was not just a snack, okay? Remember what we got to work with here, 5 barley rolls and 2 sardines. As Andrew said in verse 9, what are these for so many people? John tells us that these 8,000 to 10,000 people, in verse 11, got as much fish as they wanted. Now, think about it. I know some of y'all can put away a lot of fish. I've seen you at the fish fry we do every year. Okay, some of y'all love some fish. These people got all they, not just a little sample. You know, like the guy that, when I was working for Chick-fil-A in high school, we'd stand out in the mall with a little plate with a little sample of chicken, you know. No, 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 they didn't get a sample. They ate till they were full. This was not just a snack, because in verse 12, you know, John says it again, because the people of the crowd were filled. And not only that, but according to verse 13, there was so much left over from the contents of this little boy's Happy Meal that it filled 12 baskets. Folks, there's no way to get around this. This was a supernatural act of God working through Jesus. We also know that this was a miracle based on the response of the crowd. Look at verse 14. What do? When they saw this miraculous sign, they said, "This truly is the prophet who is to come into the world." Now remember, this is the eve of the Passover, right? What is Passover? It's the annual celebration among Jewish people every year where they remember the night that God delivered them from slavery in Egypt thousands of years ago under the leadership of who? Moses, right? So Moses and deliverance are on their mind right now because it's Passover season. They also would have remembered under Moses' leadership, as their ancestors were spending 40 years wandering around in the wilderness, how did all those people eat? God provided manna, bread, literally bread from heaven, to feed all those people. So just before Moses died, he predicted that one day God would send them another prophet just like him. It's found in Deuteronomy 18, verse 15. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him." So Moses says, one day you're going to have a prophet just like me, going to come from God. So now, here's Jesus. It's Passover season. They're hungry. Jesus provides this miracle, feeds all these people till they're about to bust from 5 barley loaves and 2 sardines. And a lot of people start adding all this up and thinking, hey, maybe this is the guy Moses was talking about. Hey, we find out later, we get down to verses 30 to 34, which we're going to look at in a few weeks. What the mob really wanted was someone who could guarantee them a steady supply of food. In other words, they were willing to worship whoever could deliver them an economic utopia where they didn't have to work for it. They just had to show up and the buffet was on. We of all people should be able to understand that impulse. Look at how many people in our country are ready to trade their freedom to whoever can promise them some economic security. On the one hand, we have the leftist socialist Jesus. On the other hand, we've got the distortions of what we call the prosperity gospel. Both of those kind of are moving from the same impulse. Well, you know, God just wants to bless everybody. No want, no need. You know, it just kind of magically appears there. Kind of like 5 barley loaves and 2 sardines. The crowd was looking for somebody to fill their bellies. Later, Jesus is going to chastise them for that and say, what you really need is somebody to fill your soul. And that's what he came to do. They couldn't look past their physical poverty enough to see how Jesus could satisfy their underlying spiritual poverty. Tied in closely with the impulse to turn Jesus into a never empty piggy bank was another false conception. Third thing I want you to notice in this passage, Jesus did not come to pilot a political movement. Okay, verse 15, Jesus perceived some of the crowd wanted to go a little further. They didn't want just a prophet, they wanted to crown him as king. Think about that temptation for a moment, right? Here you are, a carpenter from Nazareth, and you got thousands of people who want to crown you as king. And remember, at this time in history, there was nowhere in the Jewish homeland that one could go to be out from under the shadow of the Roman Empire. Judea itself, the southern part of the country, was under the direct control of a Roman military governor. The northern part of the country, where Galilee was located, was ruled by a Roman puppet, Herod Antipas. There were a lot of Jews who longed for the day for a political and military leader who could overthrow the Romans and make Israel great again. Just like today, there are so many people today who would love to enlist Christ as the figurehead for their own political agendas. And it's true that Jesus came to establish a kingdom. But as he told Pilate at his trial, his kingdom was not of this world. See, Jesus didn't come to pilot a political movement. He came to offer us eternal life. It's a grave mistake to see Jesus only as the key to economic prosperity or to political power. Jesus' goal was not to establish an economic utopia or a political order. In his own words, and jump down to verse 40, Jesus told us why he was here. "For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who beholds the Son and believes in him will have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up on the last day." Now, the obvious truth is we don't need to crown Jesus as king because guess what? He already is. Jesus is king over a kingdom that transcends and surpasses any transitory and temporary earthly kingdom. We simply need to recognize his rulership and bow our knees to his agenda instead of trying to squeeze him into ours. Over 30 years ago, the great New Testament scholar Leon Morris wrote the following about this passage. "He who is already king has come to open his kingdom to men. But in their blindness, men try to force him to be the kind of king they want. Thus they fail to get the king they want and also lose the kingdom he offers." Stop trying to squeeze Jesus into your own agenda. Instead, in faith, submit yourself to his. See him as the king he already is. Bow before him in faith. Offer him the throne of your life. Get off of that throne, give it to him. Become a true follower and allow him to begin remaking your life according to his plan. Start first by seeking his kingdom, not your own. And trust he's going to supply all the things that you really need. That's the choice that's before every single one of us. Is he king over you?
If you enjoyed this program, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at info@newsalembaptist.net. Thanks for listening.